I'm speaking today with Councilmember Ann Clutterbuck, the incumbent council member in District C. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. This is your first term for office. You're running for re-election this November.
That's right.
How has it been? Was it what you thought it would be when you first decided to run?
Yeah. It has been the most amazing 20-some-odd months for me and for all of my staff in this office. I'd like to describe it that it's much more than I ever imagined I'd be getting into. It's much more fun. It's more interesting. It's more complicated and complex and fascinating and overwhelming it's just a reminder of what an amazing city this is. We're at a great time.
Okay. You know, previously you had worked as a staffer for Congressman John Culberson. How is it different going from someone who supports the person in office to being the person in office?
And for John, I was a campaign manager. I had much more extensive experience working for Congressman Bill Archer.
Okay.
And so that was there's a difference between a campaign and the actual office. I was struck immediately comparing this office to a congressional office and my experience with Bill Archer. I was struck by the vast number of invitations we here get as opposed to those members of Congress. My experience is we get invited to a whole lot more than they do. Opportunities to speak, events in town, grand openings, ribbon cuttings, opportunities to talk about healthcare issues. And that was probably one of the biggest surprises to me is there are probably 5 opportunities every night.
Really? Do you think that's because you're here where Congress people are usually in D.C.?
Probably, yeah. And I think, it's the level of government that's closest to the people. And so, we're on the news every night, we're in the newspaper every day, and people think about us and think to invite us to things.
Okay. Well, this has been a rather eventful year for stuff in District C in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you about some of these things. Let's start with the project on Bolsover.
Yes.
Where the developer, Sonoma, wanted to and wound up agreeing with the city to buy a stretch of a one-block stretch of Bolsover. It's called an abandonment. That was a very, I guess it was a contentious issue, but sort of at a low volume level, at least from my perspective.
Yes,
it didn't generate quite as much controversy as some other things. But certainly people had strong feelings about
Absolutely.
It. And now that the decision has been made, how did the people who were on the other side, who didn't want it to happen, how have they reacted?
Well, I think that there's some tentative acceptance of it at this point. But I'd like to just, going back and discussing my approach to Bolsover, I think Bolsover illustrates what has been the biggest challenge for all of us on City Council, but especially those of us who represent the inside the loop areas, that we are grappling with the difference between balancing between continuity and change. And in a city without zoning, what's the best way for our neighborhoods to be able to adapt to increased density right on our edges? And so Bolsover provided an opportunity that in my mind for the neighbors to have a more livable area. And that's partly why the Civic Club adjacent to it supported it, and that was, I wouldn't have supported it had the neighbors really been overwhelmingly against it. But what we got out of Bolsover were several things. First of all, a more pedestrian-friendly environment. That street will remain open and as a pedestrian promenade, for lack of a better word. And for the first time ever in the city, we incorporated that into a covenant that will go with the sale of the land, that they must keep it an open pedestrian plaza. If they violate that or deviate from it in any fundamental manner, if they build on top of it, the property will revert back to the city and we will keep the over $1 million purchase price. The second thing that was unique, and the first time ever to happen in the city of Houston, is we received a commitment from Public Works that all of that money will go directly back to the neighbors affected by whether it's that street closure or drainage issues along Morningside. Morningside desperately needs reconstruction. It needs sidewalks and it needs adequate drainage. And it has not been anywhere on our CIP plan. There's just not the money to do it. But this is an opportunity for us to reinvest that money back into the immediate neighborhood. And again, that's the first time ever in the history to be able to accomplish something like that. So I'm very, very proud of that. And it's a way for the adjacent residential neighborhoods to cope as best as possible with increased density.
Now, right around the time council was taking a vote on this, the Chronicle wrote an editorial calling this poor public policy. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Well, the editor of the Chronicle, Jeff Cohen, is my neighbor. He lives about four houses down from me. And he and I have had a number of discussions about that. And I think that illustrates the struggle that we had, where reasonable minds can look at the same set of facts and come to completely different conclusions. And in this case, I would just disagree with him. I fully respect and honor and understand where he's coming from, but to me, it was good public policy to create a pedestrian plaza that would make the increased density a little bit more amenable to the neighborhood.
Okay. Right down on Kirby, there's a project going on with the storm sewer.
Yes.
That actually seems to be progressing pretty well in the area that it is now, but there's going to be a second part of this north of 59, mm-hmm. Which is going to incorporate changes to perhaps the way the street is laid out, you know, perhaps putting in a median, mm-hmm. sidewalks, trees, and stuff. This also has the look of something that's going to generate a lot of conversation, possibly controversy. What is your sort of, at this point in the project, what is your opinion about how this is going to go, and what would you like to see mm-hmm. Kirby Drive become in that area?
Mm-hmm. Yes, controversy, discussion, all of that has been generated, and this office has been extremely involved in pretty much every aspect of it since it became came to our knowledge. And my chief of staff, Tim Douglas, was in two meetings this morning about it and two yesterday, and we've been meeting diligently with the Director of Public Works and the head of traffic management, as well as the TERS. This is a project coordinated by the TERS, again a first-time opportunity. The city's taking a new approach to this, but it's being coordinated by the TERS and overseen by the City of Houston. And there are a number of problems so far that I've identified, and the first is that there just has not been enough public input, and I think the TERS is back on track and they are definitely listening. The unfortunate thing is that they were just complying with city standards and released these plans that comply with city standards, which require 11-foot lanes and a 14-foot esplanade. So the question is, how can we find some kind of compromise? And in all of these meetings that we've been having, we've been meeting with the representatives from Trees for Houston, representatives from the residential community, and then with merchants as well, trying to find a compromise that is somewhere between the existing footprint of the street and the extreme city standards. And I'm pretty confident that we'll be able to come up with that. It's a group of really outstanding individuals who all want the same thing. We definitely want better drainage in that neighborhood. We want safe streets, and we want them to be beautiful. And we're building a street for the next 50 years. And we're going to make sure that it's done beautifully and right.
Yeah, because one of the arguments I've heard about this so far is that widening the lanes would encourage faster mm-hmm. driving on Kirby, not necessarily quicker throughput because of the traffic lights, but right. faster driving, which mm-hmm. might, especially if combined with a mm-hmm. smaller sidewalk, might be considered a safety issue. What do you?
Well, interestingly, the city standards comply with the Institute of what's it?
National Architecture Institute.
Yeah, their standards. And these are the standards that a lot of the urban planners are urging us to do. And we're actually doing, I think, in the compromise, we're able to create narrower lanes. They won't be narrower than they are now. In fact, they'll be wider. The current lanes are 9.5 feet. A metro bus requires 11 feet, and that's why when you are behind a metro bus on Kirby or behind a box truck or a delivery truck, that truck usually takes up a lane and a half of the three lanes. So we do need to expand the lane width, but I think that we're going to have a wider lane on the right-hand lane and then probably on, probably about 10-foot lanes in the middle.
Okay.
And that should keep traffic from really racing down there, but those are all concerns we're thinking about. And keeping a median or an esplanade at various portions along there should help reduce the accidents.
Right, because of the two-way turn lanes mm-hmm. in the middle. And as I understand it, the timeline on this is next year, correct?
That's correct. For phase one, it's a three-phase project north of 59. Not to be confused with a Kirby project south of 59 that's also going through. And phase one is between Richmond and Westheimer.
Okay.
And that's really where our key focus is right now. That's where the drainage improvements are needed, and we hope to begin construction on those drainage improvements in January.
All right. Let's switch to a different mode of transportation, the light rail line.
Yes.
That's about to be, Metro is about to make a determination for where that line is going to be on the university's route. Do you at this point have a preference for what they might pick?
No, I do not. I do not have a preference for what they might pick. I do have a preference for making sure that that they do not have preemptive signalization of our intersections. I think it's critical to make sure that the that mobility of all kinds continues to flow and is not hampered by the rail. I think it's critical also to make sure that we mediate and lessen the impacts to development as the rail is being implemented, and I have received the commitment from Metro that they will do their rail construction in small increments so that they can button up one portion before moving on to the next rather than ripping it up stem to stern like they did on the Main Street corridor. There are a number of other business-related mediation aspects that Metro has agreed to, and I'm working very hard to make sure that those are all implemented. But I am not picking a route. This route, no matter where it goes, will run through the heart of District C, and there are neighborhood constituencies on all sides of this issue. I am staying with the commitment that the voters of District C expressed when they passed the initiative, and the voters of District C did vote convincingly on wanting light rail, and I don't plan to circumvent their will there. I think it is important that it end up on West Park at some point because the ballot language did say West Park, but there are many other aspects that need to be taken into consideration.
Do you think Metro has done an adequate job in soliciting feedback from the community?
Yes, the process set by the federal government has required that they solicit feedback, and at all of the public information meetings that I or my staff have attended, there have been tremendous turnout. Anybody who writes to me, that's also forwarded on to Metro, and I think that they have done a good job soliciting feedback. Whether or not they listen to a particular individual's feedback as opposed to another's is open to debate. it's all perception, too.
Okay. Just recently in council, there was a big argument, or I should say a debate, over the extension of the airport concessions contract. You advocated a position that this should have been made to an open bidding. Before I ask you more about that, I want to make sure that I understood your position. Were you arguing that the contract in place was not really being extended per se, but that it was sufficiently different, that it was really a new contract, In other words...
Yes.
Okay. So in other words...
That's my legal opinion, my personal opinion. When you change parties, when you change terms, when you change vendors, it is no longer an extension of a contract. It is a new contract. Moreover, in government, we are not a private company. We're not a public company. We are a governmental body. A legal entity that is supposed to operate under a certain set of standards. Currently, when we have contracts, we will let a contract, say for 8 years, whether if it's on construction, with two-year options, so that you don't have these evergreen contracts that will go on in perpetuity. This particular contract, by the time that it's expired, will have gone on for 28 years. That's bad governance. That's bad for the open process. It's bad for transparency, and it's ultimately bad for the taxpayer.
It looked to me, looking at some information I saw about it, that there were some, but I guess you could call it some provisions built into this contract that would, you know, even terminate it if the vendor did not meet certain requirements. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's sufficient? Do you think do you think what we ultimately got was adequate and reasonable?
Mm-hmm. No, I don't think it was adequate or reasonable. I would have voted for it had I thought it was adequate or reasonable. There are some safeguards in it, and I plan to work very hard to make sure that they meet all of those milestones and all of their commitments. They made a lot of promises, both on MBWE participation, on health care benefits, on a number of other aspects that we plan to scrutinize very carefully to make sure that they have complied with this new contract.
Okay. At the end of the debate, Mayor White said basically next time he would do the right thing
is what I believe what he's next time I'll listen to my gut and listen to my instinct and I'll do the right thing. And my response to him was, it's never too late to do the right thing until there's a vote. And it's unfortunate. I think it's a sad day for public process, but we will move on and hopefully this type of thing won't happen again. Apparently not in the next 2 years of his leadership. But I hope it's a cautionary tale for city council and for anybody considering running for mayor in the future.
Okay. Looking forward for you, you know, you would have two more terms in office. I think most people, when they enter into a particular office in government, they sort of have a vision in mind of what they'd like to accomplish by the time they're done. Project forward 4 years, and what would you like to have seen done by that time?
Well, there are two things I would love to have seen accomplished. The first is an alley ordinance, revising our existing and completely changing our existing alley ordinance. Alleys are a major part of our infrastructure and our public rights of way, and they have the attitude and the law at the city of Houston has been very sporadic and subjective, and it's my hope to craft an ordinance that will address that. And we are well along the way. We've been having several alley task force meetings with representatives from all of the communities that have alleys, and also with developers anticipating alley development going forward into the future.
If you'll forgive me, I don't know too much about the issue. What specifically are you looking to accomplish?
Well, these are, since they are public rights of way, having city ownership of them and acknowledgement of the ownership and allowing them to be part of the neighborhood street reconstruction process that neighbors petition, and we're well on the way to getting that, so I'm very excited about that. We hope to have a draft ordinance, and again, it'll be just a draft, ready for lots of public comment in the fall. And then the second thing I would love to have been able to accomplish by the end of four more years is a significant flood control infrastructure improvement plan.
Okay. What specifically do you have in mind? Do you think the city is spending enough on flood control and drainage right now?
No, I don't believe we are. The mayor has authorized $50 million in spending per year over a five-year period, and certainly that takes us a long way. But the estimates are that we need over $2 billion worth of flood control infrastructure in place in order to avoid a situation like happened in New Orleans. And it's my hope that we can have a consensus in the community of both our desire to accomplish that and secondly a way to fund it.
I was going to say, $2 billion is a lot more than $50 million. How do you fund that? Is that a bond, do you think?
You know, that's why we need to start talking about it as a community. I think that there are a number of ways to accomplish it. There are a number of ways that different cities have done it. And in the next 4 years, I'd like to have a dialogue with it. I think it's going to need participation also with the county and with all of the governmental entities that govern flood control.
Do you think green space is an issue? I mean, as you know, there's a draft ordinance going on about requiring developers to set aside a certain amount of park space when they build residential developments, or conversely, or to pay a fee to the city for it. Do you see that as a part of that? Do you think that's, kind of shifting gears, do you think that's an adequate solution to address the needs of Houston in terms of park space?
I'm glad you mentioned it, because I think it's an approach we can look at that absolutely cannot be separated from flood control. I think that going forward, similar to it's always bothered me that different governmental entities have buildings right next to each other, funded by the same source, the City of Houston taxpayer. Likewise, whether it's park space or flood control, I think that we can combine those two and get more bang for the buck out of it. Whether or not this ordinance is going to be the right approach is another question. There is a struggle in that discussion about whether or not it's double taxation on the property owners that are developing this land. They develop the land, they bring it, they improve it, and bring in more revenue to the city coffers. And are we now going to, is that added tax revenue simply not enough to accomplish and compensate for their use of our parks? Or do we tax new development? And that's something that we're going to be struggling with. But I think that the public would be more interested in allowing that kind of discussion if it was doubled or combined with flood detention or flood mitigation measures. Currently, developers are required to set aside certain amounts of land for flood mitigation, and I think that there's some room there for us to try to come up with, again, an answer that that meets park needs as well as flood control needs.
Okay. What advice would you give to the candidates who are running for the first time for city council, or just running for one of the open offices?
It's such an exciting time in the City of Houston, and come ready to work. It's not an easy job. City charter says it's a part-time job, but if you want to have any effect at all, it's going to be more than full-time, and I'm looking forward to working with you.
Okay. Councilmember Clutterbuck, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Charles.